This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Everyone loves a good mystery. For John Thomas, his mystery story started with a rare guitar known as a Banner Gibson and a haunting World War II-era photograph of women workers at a Gibson guitar plant in Kalamazoo. Now, the official story is that Gibson didn't make guitars during World War II, so that actually sets up two mysteries. Who were all these women, and where did all these guitars come from? John Thomas put two and two together in a new book called Kalamazoo Gals, A Story of Extraordinary Women and Gibson's Banner Guitars of World War II. John, welcome to Soundcheck.
Happy to be here.
So how do you write a book about something that doesn't officially exist?
Well, first you become intrigued. It had all the elements of a story I like. It had history. Of course, it had the intrigue, as you mentioned. It has an element of social justice if there's a denial of what happened with these women.
A denial?
There was at the time, all the way through the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, finally, I think I found a little wrinkle in time no one knew about. So I started pushing. It took me 5 years. As you pointed out, it started with that photograph of women standing in front of a factory. Gibson's in-house historian had published in 1973 that the company made no guitars during the war. That was repeated in various bits of literature around the globe. There was another small reference in another book that they had made a few guitars, and those were really great guitars because the young guys went off to war and the seasoned craftsmen stayed back.
Mm.
Kind of made sense, but there weren't any craftsmen in that photograph. They were all women.
Right.
So the next thing I needed to figure out was whether Gibson had actually made guitars. And there had been a myth that the Gibson had shipping ledgers, handwritten ledgers, but that no one could see them. I worked my way through Gibson in various ways and was told they didn't exist. And if they did, of course, I'd had no authority to find them. And then, as fate would have it, I found a very nice, apparently naive vice president who went looking for them, emailed me back about 20 minutes after my inquiry and said, I'm looking here at the ledgers and I see a shipment in 1938 to Les Paul. You can come down anytime. The next day I was on an airplane, flew down, prepared my trigger finger for the digital camera, took pictures of 4,400 pages of those handwritten shipping ledgers, and instead of no guitars, Gibson shipped 24,000. So now I've got a big mystery, right?
I mean, during World War II.
During World War II, I've got a really big mystery from zero to 24,000. And intriguingly, the guy who wrote the history and denied that Gibson made any instruments was the personnel director during the war and before the war, a guy named Julius Belson, who actually hired all these women.
Yeah.
And he was the guy who knew what went in, what went out of the factory.
Now, you know, this is the time of Rosie the Riveter, when, you know, this was a mark of patriotism and the strength of American women, that while the men were fighting at war, they were keeping the factories going. Why not play that up?
That's been my curiosity. I don't understand it at all. The advertisements of the day, Gibson advertised in a variety of music magazines and other trade magazines that it was not building any instruments and it was awaiting the return of the boys from the war.
Mm-hmm. So officially, what were they making during the war?
They did a lot of work. The guitars were probably a minority proposition for their productivity. They did a lot of wartime work. They did airplane parts.
Mm.
Gibson had woodworking skills, so the pontoons on amphibious airplanes. Gibson was early in electronics for electric guitars and amplifiers, so radio materials, radar materials. One of the Kalamazoo gals described working on something that looked like a giant firecracker with a fuse on it. So maybe some sort of bombs. I don't know.
Mm. All right. But during these years, among those 24,000 guitars that Gibson somehow squirreled out of their studios, out of their factory into the wider world, among them were the so-called Banner guitars. Now, why are they notable?
The notable one, because they have this banner. I'm the person who gave them that name. On the peg heads, the top of the guitar where the tuners attach the strings to the guitar, there's a little golden banner that reads, "Only a Gibson is good enough." This is only on the flat-top guitars, not the carved arch-top guitars with little F-holes like violins. So the flat-top folk blues mm-hmm. guitars.
The common steel-string guitar.
Common steel-string guitar. That banner slipped onto the peg heads on January 1942, and it disappeared toward the end of 1945. So, intriguingly, women stepped into Gibson January 1942. Women left Gibson, most of them, when the men returned in 45. So I could find those guitars. If I saw the banner, I knew it was a marker that women's hands had touched the guitar.
Mm.
One other great curiosity. At January 1942, when the women walked into the Gibson factory in Kalamazoo, Michigan, number one on the pop charts, then and for the following 8 weeks, Glenn Miller's I've Got a Gal in Kalamazoo. So I also had a book title.
Baby. C, D, E, F, G, H. I got a gal
in Kalamazoo.
Don't wanna boast, but I know she's a toast
of Kalamazoo, zoo, 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 zoo.
Years have gone by.
My, my, how she grew.
Liked her looks when I carried her books
in Kalamazoo.
We're speaking with John Thomas. He's a law professor at Quinnipiac University in Connecticut, freelance writer, and guitar enthusiast. His new book is called Kalamazoo Gals, a story of extraordinary women and Gibson's banner guitars of World War II, one of which you are holding as we speak.
I am holding one. This is the one that I've been able to document that went to the war. I'm the second owner. The original owner bought it shiny, brand new, 1943, took it over to the European front. He and it lived in foxholes, and he drug it across the European terrain. It looks like it today. They both returned healthy but battered, and I picked it up last fall, about when I finished the book, from the original owner's son.
Wow. So are these things collector's items? Are they rarities?
They are, well, they are. Well, they don't exist. How much rarer can you get?
Right.
There aren't any.
They don't officially exist,
right.
Yes.
They are rare. The Gibson built of the flat tops about 9,000, I've counted, of the 24,000 total instruments. They have been renowned as these really great, great guitars, maybe the pinnacle of Gibson's production, even though apparently they didn't exist. So they had been collectible even prior to my book.
So, you know, one could expect out in the open market to find five-figure sums for some of these guitars.
That's right. The top of the line are already five-figure guitars.
So, give me a sense of why these are so collectible. How do these guitars sound?
Well, they sound like this. So this is, they're beautiful, they're open, they're very lightly built. Partly, I can explain in a minute about women's hands, how they made these guitars. But you can hear just a little bit.
I mean, having played this instrument shortly before we went on the air today, the action is it's a very easy instrument to play. You know,
the guitars have always been known as very easily playable guitars, great sounding guitars.
Great sound, yeah. So all of these women enter the Gibson factory in 1942, start making these guitars. This would probably be a good time for us to meet one of those Kalamazoo gals. You spoke with Irene Stearns during the writing of your book.
Irene Stearns, in my view, is the Kalamazoo gal. She'll deny that she did anything interesting, but she's fascinating, and she's one of my favorite people and one of my heroes in the world. Irene actually built the strings for the guitars rather than the guitars themselves, mm-hmm. and she remembers everything that ever happened in Gibson.
Irene Stearns, welcome to Soundcheck.
Now what?
Hi, Irene.
Hi.
So, Irene, do you remember when you first started working at the Gibson factory in Kalamazoo?
Well, I remember, going in and all that. I graduated in 1940, and then I looked for a job for about 6 months. There weren't any jobs. So I pounded the pavement for 6 months, and then one day Gibson called me.
They called you?
Well, I see, at that time, everybody went around to every factory, every place that had a name on the door to get a job.
Yeah.
And we did that every day. Every day I got on the bus, went downtown. Upjohn was first choice. Parchment was second choice. Then we went any place else that had a name just to get any job. So I had my name in at Gibson. Well, then we didn't even have a phone, so one of the neighbors came running over one day and said, Gibson called and said that they had a job for you.
So wow.
That's how I started.
Now, did you have any idea that, you know, that Gibson was hiding the fact that they had a factory full of women at the time?
No. Well, it was all women at that time everywhere you went.
Yeah.
You know, all the men were gone.
So what did you do at the Gibson Guitar Factory?
Well, I sat there and made strings all day long.
Steel guitar strings?
Yeah, well, mandolin, guitar, banjo. I made the single strings, so I sat down all day. And along the wall by the windows were the wound strings, and those people stood up all day long and just made strings.
John, what Irene's talking about is the difference between wound strings and single strings. On your guitar, the wound strings are the four lower.
Right, the low strings, and the ones Irene made, the high strings.
Right, right. Which are don't have the winding on them.
Right, now one of the great experiences of my life, and Irene will remember this, when I met Irene, I talked my way through the property manager into the old building, and Irene and I and her daughter Julie spent, 3 hours or something wandering the building, and Irene would stop and tell me what had been going on in each room during the war.
Now, Irene, had you ever played a guitar before?
No. I don't know anything about them, except I enjoy hearing them.
Now, would people come and play the instruments there in the factory?
Well, yeah. I didn't get downstairs where they actually made the guitars, but I was in the string room and near the wall. And on the other side of the wall is where they came in to try out their instruments and bring out the guitars that the guys ordered, like all the popular people, you know, all the celebrities would be in there. And they would try out their guitar, and I could sit there and make strings and listen to them all day. So that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
I didn't know who these people were. Well, there was Gene Autry and some of the others. But at that time, you know, we didn't know how famous they were.
I got the sense, Irene, that Gene Autry was the most famous because you and the other Kalamazoo gals could remember a number of musicians, but the only name you could remember was Gene Autry. He must have been huge, huge star.
"'Twould be better for us had we never in this wide, wicked world ever met. For the pleasures we've both seen together, I am sure, love, I'll never forget. Oh, I'm thinking tonight of my blue eyes, who is sailing far over the sea. Oh, I'm thinking tonight of my blue eyes, and I wonder if she ever thinks of me."
But finally, I got a different job that was a lot more fun. I did the coiling.
Coiling the strings, so they
package,
so put
little,
in the package, yeah.
Yeah, package them up.
All right.
And that was a lot of fun.
Now, Irene, John mentioned that, you know, the women started arriving, you know, at about the time the men were leaving, and that when the men returned from war in late 45, the women essentially left Gibson. What happened? How long were you there? Were you there at the end of this period?
No, I had different jobs during the war. Gibson most of the time, and then Shakespeare's.
Shakespeare's made fishing rods and that sort of thing,
yeah.
Right? But during the war, made parachutes.
But at that time, we were working on B-29s. And so I was an inspector for some of the parts of the B-29. That was kind of scary. I thought, boy, if I don't do this right,
something really bad could happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Irene, when John Thomas here came calling and wanted to talk to you about this weird job you had for a while many, many years ago, did you just look at him and say, "What is wrong with you?"
Yeah, I did. Well, I saw the ad in the paper, and I thought, oh, shoot, what would they want with me? And then my daughter Julie said, "Come on, Mom, let's go." So we went down there, and with fear and trembling, we thought, who's this John?
Well, I had some fear and trembling, too, Irene. Remember me?
I know.
I wondered, what are these?
We all looked at each other,
right.
And as soon as we started talking and laughing, why, then it was a lot of fun. And I thought, well, I guess John's okay.
Well, Irene, you're okay, too. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you.
Irene Stearns is one of the Kalamazoo gals who worked at the Gibson Guitar Factory during the years of the Second World War. Her story is part of John Thomas's book, Kalamazoo Gals, A Story of Extraordinary Women and Gibson's Banner Guitars of World War II. So what did happen at the end of 45, John?
When the men returned, most of the women ceded their jobs back voluntarily. As far as I know, Gibson didn't have to tell any of them to leave, but because of gender roles of the day, almost all of them went back to become homemakers. In fact, almost every woman with a hint of regret in her voice said, you know, that's what we did in those days, so I stopped working.
So while they were working, they're kind of thrust into this really artisanal kind of instrument making,
right,
without any did any of them have any idea what they were doing?
No, I asked a couple of naive questions. The first question was, what kind of training did you get? And each one of the women looked at me and said, what do you mean by training? Well, who showed you how to do it? Nobody. What did you do? Well, I sat down and watched what the person next to me did. This guitar, for instance, that I'm holding, the bracing is supposed to be symmetrical, crossing in the center. It's about an inch off center. No one told the woman where to glue the braces.
This is inside the body
inside,
of the instrument.
Yeah.
So how did they make such great guitars?
I guess two answers. One is why they were great. And so I did what anybody would do. I x-rayed them. So I decided, why not?
Is that what anybody would do?
Of course. So I figured, you know, the university where I work has a diagnostic imaging facility. And I'm sort of scratching my head thinking, how could I try to find out differences? And I called them up thinking they'd laugh me out of the building, and they thought, no, this will be interesting. So I contacted collectors up and down the eastern corridor of the U.S., and we got assemblage of just before the war, just after the war, and World War II guitars, x-rayed a bunch of them, and proved beyond doubt definitively that radiologists would rather look at x-rays of guitars than knees. Published two pieces in a radiology journal, got lots of commentary. But they were all more refined. We had state-of-the-art technology. I could measure everything to the tenth of an inch, the 10,000th of an inch. And they were everything, the tops, the back sides, the braces were a little more refined. And so I'm thinking about this while I'm talking to the women, and they have no training. So I think this is the second question I asked them, and this is the really naive question. I said, well, did you have any hobbies? I highly recommend never ask a woman who grew up in the Depression, to raised a family, and worked through the war, if you have a hobby. What do you mean a hobby? I don't have any time for hobbies, young man. But then I followed up. Well, did you do any sewing, needlepoint, crocheting, knitting? Oh, every single one. So my contention is, untrained, unbeknownst to Gibson, January 1942, its most skilled workforce in history walks through those doors, builds these glorious guitars. The war ends. They go back to doing the gender roles at the time. And we're left with, one, the denial that the guitars existed. But if you find them, they're really, really great guitars.
All right. Now, you have the book out. There are guitars out there.
There's
like all kinds of evidence. What, if anything, have you heard from the Gibson Company?
Initially, nothing. I think Gibson was a company, like most companies, really interested in economic survival, not much interested in its past. But as the story grew and as people became to call me the Banner Gibson guy or the X-ray guy, Gibson came calling. And we've got a really interesting project now. I just sent four guitars over the summer up to Gibson with the X-rays. And they measured them, did sonic fingerprints of them, and we are in the process of duplicating exactly the guitars, bringing women who – they still have women in the factory – bringing those women over to work on these guitars and working toward using a percentage of each sale for a contribution to a women's history project of some kind.
Very nice. And another related project, you've actually – once you had gathered all these Gibson Banner guitars – actually had some songs recorded.
Right. So I decided, because it's a story about guitars, the printed page doesn't quite convey that, and I really wanted to record the voices of these guitars in a way to give voice to the women who've been forgotten in history. So I came up with another crazy idea and came across a great, great Americana artist, Lauren Sheehan, and proposed to her that we record this companion CD. And my theory was I'd found 12 women in this photograph, and I wanted to do 12 songs with 12 different guitars. Out went the word again to collectors around the globe. People sent me guitars. No one ever asked when they would get it back or actually even whether they would get it back. And we recorded these dozen songs, each with a different guitar. They sound different, but we recorded them pristine, very, very, sort of basic, real recordings.
Well, let's hear one of those recordings from guitarist Lauren Sheehan playing one of these World War II-era Gibson Banner guitars, the subject of John Thomas's new book called Kalamazoo Gals, A Story of Extraordinary Women and Gibson's Banner Guitars of World War II. John, it is a fascinating story. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
All right, now that we've unraveled the mystery of the Kalamazoo Gals, who built guitars and made strings in the Gibson factory during World War II, let's actually hear from a modern-day Kalamazoo gal. Mamie Minch works as a luthier and a guitar tech at the Brooklyn guitar shop known as Retrofret. She's been here in our studio before with her band, the Roulette Sisters. Mamie, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John.
I just got to say, Mamie is such a Kalamazoo gal, World War II kind of name.
What can I say?
Is it short? What was it short for?
It's generally short for Mary or Margaret. In my case, it's short for Mary. I was named after my great-grandmother.
Okay. But you know the story of the Kalamazoo gals.
Yes, I do.
So what's your reaction to the story?
I'm just so tickled that it's coming out in this way, you know, not just for people who consider themselves guitar geeks, which is a group I belong to.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a pretty accessible story.
Now, as a woman working in what has been traditionally a male-dominated field for so many years, were you even aware that this kind of blip in the screen of history had happened?
Marginally. I mean, you know, women were doing all of these jobs during World War II, and I knew that some women were working there. Over the decades, it's become clear that it was almost exclusively women. And it's just so fascinating to, at this point, have someone go and speak with the women who are still alive, and speak with their families, gather their stories.
Now, what about the Banner guitars? I mean, as a player, as a technician, what is it about these instruments that's noteworthy?
That's a really good question. And, you know, what makes any guitar great? There's an element of mojo in it, just period. You know, you can't really pinpoint it.
So it's really hard. You couldn't say, I mean, John has x-rayed these instruments and talked about, you know, the proportions and the way things are put together.
And those things are true. But any one of those things doesn't necessarily make a special instrument. It's something of the combination of them. Many of the, you know, the incremental measurements are ever so slightly more refined. But there are also some weird things that were wrong because, as John probably told you, the people who were – these women didn't necessarily receive the training you'd imagine that they would, right? So they were a little bit making it up as they went along.
Yeah.
So
– And – but – so how do guitarists feel about these instruments?
I mean, they're the best. Ask anyone. You know, I've had weak in the knees moments playing these guitars. They're just fantastic.
So, Mamie, what do you do at Retrofret?
Well, I'm the head of repair. I came to the shop as a customer, and I was in my early 20s, and I play a sort of a vintage-inspired style of blues guitar and write songs, and I really, really wanted a 1930s National, so I fell in love with this guitar.
The National, for folks who don't know, this is a steel-clad guitar.
Yeah, not just steel-clad, it's made of steel. So
they're heavy.
They are heavy. You know, they may have appealed to these early blues players because they were, you know, could help you out of a bar fight if you really needed a weapon. If you've ever carried one on an international flight like I have, you can't forget how heavy they are. Anyway, I wanted one, and I heard that they had one, and it's like this special experience to go find this shop, Retrofret. It's like a little guitar speakeasy. You have to know what you're looking for. You have to know exactly
where it's there.
You have to know it's on Butler Street. It's in this unmarked building, this unmarked two-story turn-of-the-century brick factory building. It's just a really special experience. And you ring the buzzer, and then you go across the roof. It's the old ASPCA building.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you really feel like you're entering.
And do you need a secret password to gain admission to
the
inner
sanctum?
Yes,
go to the website. We'll tell you what it is. Anyway, so I would go and visit. And as a young woman who's also a serious instrumentalist, it was so cool to be taken seriously by these fellas.
Well, now let me ask you about that. It's one thing to be taken seriously as a player. At the point when you got behind the bench and started fixing these things, you know, how did that work out?
Good question. You know, I like to think that my time in the music world kind of toughened me up for that. And, you know, I won't speak ill of any of my clients. Sometimes people are surprised one at my age, and that I'm much younger than the other people in the shop. You know, and now I'm in my 30s, but when I started, I was in my mid-20s, and that I'm a woman. And every once in a while, I still get someone who's expecting the head of repair to come out the door and help them with someone who continues waiting after I come through the door and say hello. I have two women working under me. You know, one is an assistant tech, and I began as an assistant tech. Mm-hmm. I basically apprenticed with my boss, Steve Urich, who's been doing it for 40 years. It was a long process. It took me about 5 years to become head of repair.
Right. Now, could you and the other two women there at Retrofret, could you make a guitar?
Certainly.
And would it be up to Banner Gibson standards?
That's a great question. Lord knows.
You do not need to answer that.
We have our own mojo. I don't know if it would be the same mojo.
Okay. Well, a well-said answer. We've been speaking with Mamie Minch. She is a luthier and guitar technician at the Brooklyn guitar shop Retrofret. So talking about the Kalamazoo gals, just to kind of put a bow on this, Mamie, do you hope that this story sort of leads more women, more young women into this particular corner of the music world?
I certainly do. It's a wonderful way to make a living and spend your days. And I think, I think women would bring a lot of strengths to this that I hope they're not too intimidated by the male-dominated nature of the field to experiment with.
All right. Mamie Minch, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, John.
This is Soundcheck.
Me, I want to be on board a radio. Yes, I want to be on board a radio. And if I can get to board a radio, I mean they will hear me all over this lane. All the way from the green hills of old Spokane to the muddy shoreline of Lake Pontchartrain. Up, up and away they will all know my name, and I mean they will hear me all over this land. I mean all over this land. All over this land.
All over this land.
All over this land.
All over this land.
I mean they will hear me all over this land.
That's the song Border Radio by Mamie Minch. This is Soundcheck.